steps farther into the room. "As you like to remind me," he says, "I am a prince. This is where royalty who don't want to be found go to never be found."
"This is where we should always stay."
Kai throws himself onto a plush fur chair that leans against the farthest wall.
"There's no rum, but damn if these beds aren't good."
"Like you're going to find out," Madrid says with a smile.
"Only enough beds for half of us, remember? And I think it's your turn for floor duty."
"We can't share."
He presses an injured hand to his chest. "Plenty of women would kill to climb into bed with me." Madrid bristles.
"They're single beds," she says sharply.
Undeterred, Kai places a hand on her knee.
"I'll flip you for it."
Madrid pushes his hand from her leg.
"Heads, I win. Tails, you're an idiot."
"Torek should sleep on the floor," Kai says, settling back into the chair. "He's always on about home comforts being dangerous for making us believe we actually have a home."
Torek casts him a side eye.
"I know enough about knives to stick them where the sun don't shine if you aren't careful."
Kai smirks.
"It's not good form for someone like me to sleep on the floor. I'm practically an aristocrat."
Torek casts him a blank, unimpressed stare.
"You're an aristocrat," he says.
I look to Elian, who stands like a statue beside me. It's surprising not to hear him chime in with his crew's tender insults, or smile as they carelessly throw cheers around. He brings his hand to the back of his neck, unsure what to do with himself when he's not smiling.
"So our next step is to hide out here?" I ask.
"Our next step is to try to think of how we're going to get our hands on an ancient artifact without revealing who we are," Elian says.
"Steal," I correct. "How you're going to steal an ancient artifact?"
"It's not stealing if you're stealing it back."
Elian slips out of his jacket and throws it onto the table behind him.
"The necklace belongs to the Pagus family. I bargained a lot to get my hands on the map that shows their route up the mountain. But without the necklace, all of it is for nothing. She told me it was the key to the hidden dome."
"She?" I repeat. "Who are you talking about?"
"The princess of Pagus," Elian says.
His eyes dart to Kai, and a strange look passes between them. Kai clears his throat.
"You mean she sacrificed her family's secrets for jewelry?"
I scoff.
"How trite."
Elian raises an eyebrow.
"If I remember rightly," he says with a look that is far too smug,
"you were willing to sacrifice your life for a necklace."
"I was willing to sacrifice yours first," I say.
Long after the rest of the crew disappears into sleep, Elian and I sit together. We plot in the most ghastly ways, scheming through each detail of his plan, including how to get the princess her family's necklace without getting a bullet in our hearts. Key points I'm keen to clarify. Sunlight threatens to spill through the tiny round window above us, buried in the arch of the ceiling. The candles have died down to withering embers, and their faint afterglow casts blurry shadows around us. The smell of dawn smokes through the air, and with it the grayness seeps in from the outside world.
"I still don't understand how you know that these pirates have the necklace," I say.
"The Zapror are infamous for stealing from royalty," Elian explains, palming a licorice stick. "If there's a precious heirloom missing anywhere in the world, you better believe that Talus Rycroft and his band of pirate thieves have it in hand."
"Even if that's true, wouldn't they have sold it by now? What use would it be to keep something like that?"
"You're assuming that Rycroft needs to steal to survive," Elian says. "Maybe he did once, but now he steals just to prove that he can. A necklace like that carries prestige. It would be more of a trophy to him than a treasure. Just another artifact to prove how good he is."
"If he's that good," I say, "how are you going to steal it from him? I think he might notice your hand running through his pockets."
"Misdirection,"
Elian takes a bite out of the licorice stick.
They look over here.
He waves a hand theatrically.
While I'm pilfering over here.
He wags his other hand at me, looking all too satisfied.
As long as you can manage to look innocent and above suspicion.
And if that doesn't work?
I have a backup plan.
Elian produces a small vial from his pocket with a flourish.
It's less wily, but equally duplicitous.
Poison, I muse. Were you keeping that around for your future wife?
It's not lethal, Elian says.
For a killer, he seems oddly offended at the idea.
And no.
He pauses, then turns to me with a half-smile.
Unless you were my wife.
If I were your wife, then I'd take it.
Ha!
He throws his head back and pockets the vial once more.
Thankfully, that's not something we have to worry about.
Because you're betrothed? He hesitates.
Why would you say that?
You're royal, I tell him. That's what royalty does. They marry for power. I think back to the flesh eater, and the way my mother's voice turned into a song when she told me she had chosen her finest warrior to continue our line. The orange rusted blood in the corners of his lips as he regarded me with a mix of hunger and regimented disinterest. And on the sod, just nights before, when he claimed me even in my human body, an uneasiness creeps through me at the memory.
I don't want it to be that way, Elian says. When I marry, it won't be about power.
What will it be then?
Sacrifice.
His voice is crisp. There's a certainty to it, as though he's resigned to the fact rather than proud of it. He swallows, just loud enough to catch me off guard, and the action makes me shift, his discomfort snaking through the air toward me. Elian's eyes drop to the floor. And I feel as though I've exposed him, or he's laid himself bare and suddenly regrets it. Either way, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to say, and find something about the moment seems so personal, too personal, that I find myself searching for anything to fill the quiet. You're right, I tell him, trying to shake the melancholy from my voice. Spending a lifetime with you would be a sacrifice.
Oh?
A glow returns to Elian's eyes, and he smiles as though the last few seconds didn't happen, erasing whatever parts of his past he doesn't want to remember.
What would you be losing?
He asks. If I married you? I stand to tower above him, pushing away the unraveling thing inside me. I suppose it would be my mind. I turn, and the ricochets of his laughter follow me out of the room. But even with that infectious melody, I can't shake the look that crossed his face when I mentioned marriage. It makes me more curious than I ought to be. I think sinister thoughts, but I know the most likely of them is an arranged marriage, ordered by the Midasan king to bind their kingdom to another. Maybe the weight Elian carries is born from the shackles of a royal life and a kingdom that is unwanted but needed all the same. It's something I can understand. Another similarity between us that I'd be blind not to note. In the pits of our souls, if I amuse myself with the notion that I have a soul, Elian and I aren't so different. Two kingdoms that come with responsibilities we each have trouble bearing. Him, the shackles of being pinned to one land and one life. Me, trapped in the confines of my mother's murderous legacy. And the ocean, calling out to us both. A song of freedom and longing.
26. Elian. Stealing is something I first mastered when I was 16 and spent the better part of the year in the northern Isle of Clefdis. Everything was new, and it was all I could do not to beg everyone I met for a piece of their history, a skill or a story only they knew. I wanted it all. My crew was barely a crew, and I was barely a man, let alone a pirate. After Kai, Torek was one of the first men I recruited. And with his addition, my father insisted on a ship capable of the task I set myself, while I insisted on something that was more weapon than boat. I gained Torek's unyielding loyalty in his home country of Anthracus, where the mines run deep, and coal travels through the wind in a song. But though he was great with a pistol, and even greater with a sword, even he didn't have the stomach for the brute force that was needed to kill a siren. And as the days went on, I found I was the same. I needed to be more agile. Cleftis breeds thieves, but more than that, it breeds ghosts. Men and women traded like cattle, reared to be demons and killers and whatever else their masters demand. Subject to the whims of slavers who would sooner sell their own people than lose a trinket. They are trained to be as invisible as they are deadly, able to sweep in through the night unnoticed and carry out deeds that could never be done in the light of day. I wanted to learn from them, and one day, when the mantle of king was forced upon me, inflict the same suffering on them that they inflicted on the world. Sirens weren't the only enemy. Humans could be just as demonic, and it was a wonder to me that my father and the other kingdoms hadn't banded together to wage war on Cleftis. What good was a global peace treaty if the kingdoms were savaging themselves? Of course, Madrid changed that. When I strode into Cleftis and saw her, tattooed and bleeding from so many wounds, it was hard to make out her face beneath it all. I realized that some things couldn't be fixed. In a world that bred killers as easily as ours, the best I could hope for was to make them mine. Killers couldn't undo death, but they could find new prey. They could find a different kind of pain to inflict. I stare at the Zafra as they prepare their ship for sail. They are Cleftesis snatchers, known for sleuthing into kingdoms and leaving with the most precious jewels. Masters of disguise who have stolen heirlooms from too many royals to count. They would be legends if they weren't so reviled by the ruling families. It would be easy enough to declare a bounty on their heads, but nobody would be brave enough to try their hand at it. Going after one of these Zafra would be like going after a member of the Saad, which means that it would be suicide. Not to mention that the Zafra are good at stealing from royalty, but even better at stealing for royalty. Thieves for hire, whom most of the families don't dare think of crossing, for fear they may need their services one day. Luckily, I don't have that fear. I watch Talus Rycroft lounge at the base of the mighty dock steps. He counts his loot brazenly. Fingers slick with the kind of speed that comes only from years of earning nothing and taking everything. I'm not one to listen to the stories that filter through our world like grains of salt through open hands, but there's something about Rycroft that has always set me on edge. He owns a slave ship in the Northern Isle. I can't be sure which, and I know it's unlikely to be the same vessel Madrid had to murder her way out of. But there isn't a member of my crew who doesn't bristle at his name. Politics prevail, though, and declaring a feud with the Zafra wouldn't be worth it. I look to Madrid and Kai, who tucked themselves behind the shrubs beside me. While Kai turns to me with a questioning stare, Madrid's eyes stay focused on Rycroft, unblinking. She won't risk letting him out of her sight. She doesn't risk anything when it comes to her countrymen. It's why Kai insisted he be in her squad, if for nothing else than to hold her back if the time comes. Torek has taken flank across the way with more of the crew, weapons poised for whatever could go wrong. To approach Rycroft with my crew in any place outside of a tavern would arouse suspicion. I have to be cautious and clever, which is lucky, because I like to think I'm always both of those things at any given time. I turn to Lyra. She looks like a portrait, with deep copper hair pulled from her star-freckled face, only confirming the fact that she isn't capable of lying low. Not saying whatever crosses her damned mind. Lyra can keep secrets, but she can't by any stretch of the imagination keep peace. While I have ample practice in pretend, there's too much fire in Lyra's eyes for such things. Some people burn so brightly it's impossible to put the flames out. Thankfully, that's just what I need. The captain of the Sod approaching another pirate ship with his league of siren killers would only end in death. But Elian Midas, prince and arrogant son of a bitch, strolling through the docks with a new woman on his arm, too brazen to be a sleuth or a spy, that just might work. Rycroft might just let enough of his guard down to let us aboard his ship. And once we are on board, all I need is for Lyra to confirm he has what we are looking for. If you're ready, I say to Lyra, I give you permission to risk your life for me. She lifts her chin. There's something about the way she carries herself that reminds me of the women at court. She has the air of someone with a lifetime of never knowing anything but her own way. I know because I have an identical look, though I try to hide it, I know it's still there. The entitlement, the stubbornness that can never truly be lost. It's not a look that belongs on the face of a lost orphan girl. I make to take her hand and head toward Rycroft's ship. When Kai grabs onto my shirt sleeve, he doesn't need to say anything. I can read the look in his eyes telling me that he'd rather be the one by my side if we're going head on with Rycroft. Truth be told, I'd feel better having him there too. Thing is, as pretty as Kai might find himself, I don't think Rycroft would agree. And what I need right now is an inconspicuous companion, not a pirate-shaped protector. Just trust me, I tell him. It's not you I don't trust. Lyra laughs, like someone worrying about my safety is the funniest thing she's heard all day. Better be careful, she tells me. I could strike a bargain with the Zapra and use those 3 days of sword training to stab you in the back. As though you'd ever abandon the luxuries of the Sod for Rycroft's rust boat, I say, gesturing to Rycroft's ship. It isn't a bad vessel, but it's no match for the deadly beauty of the Sod. With a redwood body and sails the color of ash, it's more than worthy for looting. But to hunt the Prince's Bane and her sea witch mother, or hold a prince whose heart does not beat but crashes like ocean waves, well, it's not quite capable of that. I don't see much difference, Lyra says. Paint the wood a shade darker, give the captain a large chip for his shoulder, and I wouldn't notice a thing. I widen my eyes outraged, but Lyra only smiles. Just remember, she says, blue eyes glistening. If you want this scum to believe you and I could be together, her voice echoes with shameless disbelief, then you need to take off that ridiculous hat. Just you remember, I say as we step out from behind the shrubs and approach my lounging rival. If we're caught, there's no way in hell I'm risking my neck to save you. Rycroft spots us the moment we maneuver out of the dark and into the unforgiving light of the star-dappled sky. He doesn't speak as we approach, or move from his sprawling position on the dock steps that lead to his ship. But I know he sees us. He continues counting his riches, but his moves are more precise. It's not until we are directly above him that he deigns to look up with a gold-studded grin. Objectively speaking, Talus Rycroft isn't a handsome man. His features don't quite seem to belong to him, just another thing he's stolen. His eyes are dark pits that bore into his ashen skin, and his lips are pale brown, thin and curved upward in a permanent smirk, hooded by a slender mustache. A deep burgundy turban wraps around his head, and from it large pieces of gold and silver hang like droplets, falling into his face and down his neck. When he looks at me, he runs his tongue over his lips.
"Where's your god, dog?"
he asks in heavy clefthises.
"Which one?"
I reply in Madassan, not willing to give him the satisfaction of making me use the tongue of thieves and slavers. Ryecroft stands and leans against the rope of the dock steps.
"If you're here, Kai and that tattooed whore can't be far off. And let me guess, she has a target on my head, like a peasant prince would dare take me out."
I school my features into surprise. "Such paranoia," I say. "It's just me and my lady friend, alone and unarmed, really. You can't be scared of a single pissant prince, can you?"
Ryecroft narrows his eyes. "And this one?"
He casts a lecherous grin toward Lyra. Though I'm sure she doesn't speak the language, there aren't many outside Clefthys who do. Her face twists in measured disgust. "Not a guard dog," I tell him.
"Really?"
He slips into Madassan and lets an alley cat grin loose on his face.
"Looks like a bitch to me."
I keep a lofty smile on my face. "You're as pleasant as ever." I slip a lazy arm around Lyra's waist. She bristles and then eases herself rigidly into my grip. "And after my new friend and I came to admire your ship."
"Admire it?"
Ryecroft repeats.
"Or steal it?"
"An entire boat." I give him my most shit-eating grin. "It's nice to know you have such a high opinion of me." I turn to Lyra. "Do you think it could fit in your purse?"
"Perhaps," she says. "Nothing here looks very big."
She casts a meaningful look at Ryecroft, and I cough, covering my mouth to hide the possibility of laughter. Ryecroft snarls.
"Okay," he says. "I'll play this out."
He opens his arms in a dangerous welcome, revealing the full mass of the ship behind him.
"Come aboard. We'll talk over rum fit for a king."
It's a jab. A double-edged sword to point out what I've not yet become and mock me with what I will one day be. Never a pirate, always a prince. I accept Ryecroft's invitation with a curt nod and keep my arm wrapped protectively around Lyra. My every instinct is on edge, telling me to walk behind him and not in front, watch his hands and his eyes and the 24 men who are leering down at us as we settle around a table on the ship deck. To never, for a single second, think that he doesn't wish me dead. And that he's not going to try to make that wish come true when I steal the Peggy's necklace. The rum Ryecroft offers us is from Midas, which wouldn't bother me half as much if it wasn't also from the royal cellar. The bottle is blown glass, twisted into the shape of our crest, with liquid gold printing the intricate details. The drink itself is littered with gold dust that glistens against the reflection of the glass. I don't know when he stole it or why. If he did it just because he could, or if he did it just because he wanted me to know that he could. But my hands clench into fists under the table. I pray to the gods that Madrid's finger slips on her trigger.
"How's it taste?"
Ryecroft asks. Lyra brings the goblet to her lips and inhales. I'm not sure if she's smelling for poison or if she actually wants to savor the drink. But she closes her eyes and waits a few moments before bringing the goblet to her mouth. There is a spot of blood on her tongue when she licks her lips, from the shards of gold that dance inside the bottle. When Lyra runs her tongue over her lips, my hands unclench and the anger seeps from me. Everything she does is sensual, playing her part as perfectly as she can. Or maybe she doesn't need to act and simply enjoys the lustful way Ryecroft's teeth scrape his lips when he watches her.
"It's
perfectly lovely, Lyra says, her voice almost unrecognizable.
Good. Ryecroft's smile could cut through steel. I wouldn't want you to be unsatisfied.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about that, Lyra says. Not now that I'm in such good company.
Ryecroft's eyes fill with a calculating lust. He blinks at her, then turns to me. Are you going to tell me the reason for your visit? He asks. Or shall we keep playing this game?
There was never an option to stop playing. String him along and let his suspicions get the better of him. Let him think that I'm up to no good while Lyra plays to his ego and swoons on his every senseless word. Let him think that he needs to watch my every move and scour the docks where my crew waits. Let his attention be on everything but the newly demure Lyra, the harmless arm piece I'm flaunting in front of him like the jackass prince I am. Actually, I say, swirling the goblet of rum, there is something. Ryecroft leans back and hoists his feet onto the table.
Spit it out, he says. If it's a trade you want, we can come to an agreement.
His eyes flicker to Lyra and she smiles coyly. I didn't realize she was capable of looking coy, but it seems I've underestimated her skills of deceit. She wraps a winding piece of hair around her finger, so convincing that I have to do a double take to catch the clamped fist she's concealing under the table. Her face betrays nothing of it.
A yellow sapphire amulet disappeared from the Madassan royal vaults, I say, recalling the lie verbatim as we practiced.
I was hoping you might know something.
Ryecroft's strange features fill with delight. He arches his arms behind his head. So, you've come slinging accusations.
He looks far too pleased by it. It's precious to me, I tell him. If it were to suddenly reappear, or if you caught word of where it might be, the information would be very valuable. Priceless, one might say. I can almost see Ryecroft weigh the options of whether he should pretend he has something of mine just to watch me squirm, or offer to help me find it for a fee as large as he would like.
I don't have it, Ryecroft tells me like a moth to the flame. But I've heard whispers.
Lies, I think. Such bullshit lies.
It's possible I know where it is.
I swallow my smirk and feign intrigue at the chance that he could have the location of my imaginary Madassan heirloom. What would that information cost me?
Time, he says, for me to check my sources are correct.
For him to actually gather sources.
And I think I'd also like your ship.
I knew it was coming. For every unpredictable thing Ryecroft did, there were 100 more easily guessed. What better way to make a prince suffer than to take away his favorite toy? I let a flicker of practiced irritation cross over my features. Not going to happen.
It's your ship or your amulet, Ryecroft says. You have to decide.
And how do I know you're not the one who has it? I time my anger in perfect pulses. I'm not paying you to give me back something you've already stolen. Ryecroft's eyes go dark at the insinuation.
I told you I didn't have it.
I'm not going to take your word for it.
So what? You want me to take you below decks and let your sneaky shit fingers trawl through my treasures? He asks.
Which is exactly what I want. The entire reason we came here and talked our way onto his ship was to get a look at his spoils and confirm that Sakura's necklace is among them.
If you think that's happening, Ryecroft says, then you're stupider than you look.
Fine, I glare, spoiled, impatient, playing my part just as he would expect. I wave a dismissive hand over to Lyra. Let her look instead. I don't care either way, but unless one of us has a peek at the unmentionables you're hiding, you can keep your ship and watch the Sod sail off into the sunset without you. It was always going to be Lyra, of course. I knew there wasn't a chance in hell Rycroft would let the captain of the Sod into his treasure trove. But to let one of the Medassan Prince's captivating floozies take a quick look around? Maybe.
Her. Rycroft repeats with a snake smile. How will she know what she's looking for?
It's yellow sapphire, I tell him. She's not a complete idiot. Lyra kicks me under the table, hard. Rycroft shoots her a devil's smile and turns to one of his approaching shadows. The man is older than I am, his skin burnished by the sun, and I can't help but think he looks familiar. A cleaver is sheathed to his belt, and large earrings stretch chasms into his lobes. When he leans down to whisper into Rycroft's ear, he sweeps a long velvet coat out of the way. I straighten, knowing where I've seen him before. The man from the Golden Goose. The one who started this quest by pointing me in the direction of the Sea Queen's weakness. He's one of the Zapra. It was Rycroft who sent me after the crystal.
I have new bargain for you, Rycroft says, all teeth. Now that my men have sights on your crew, how about we both be a little more honest? Your guys are good at hiding, but they're not, Zapra. What they are is screwed, and they'll be dead if you don't tell me exactly how you plan to get the crystal of Keto.
I don't blink. Never heard of it.
Whose life should I bring you to get your memory going?
Rycroft slides his finger across the rim of his goblet.
The tattooed bitch with the gun. Or maybe I'll slice the giant a new smile. Pick a person and I'll pick the body part.
I arch an eyebrow. That's very dramatic.
I like dramatic, he says. How about Kai's head on a platter?
How about me killing you before your crew can even blink? Rycroft smiles.
But then, where would your friends be?
He gestures to one of the Zapra, who pours him another measure of rum.
So you kill me as a trade for their lives, I ask.
Rycroft throws his head back.
Now who's dramatic? I wouldn't risk starting a war with your daddy.
He waves a hand.
Just tell me what I want to know.
How about you tell me why you're suddenly so interested in the crystal? Rycroft leans back in his chair, letting his gold teeth track to a lazy smile.
I've had my sights on it for a while. Every pirate likes hunting for lost treasure, and the more elusive it is, the better. You know that, don't you, Your Highness?
Rycroft pulls aside his collar. The necklace is not quite what it was like in the stories. The stone is not a stone, but a droplet of blue that teeters from the chain like it's ready to fall. Each fragment of it dances as though it's made of water, with small ornate fangs latching around the diamond. The Lost Piggy's necklace. I was right. Rycroft does have it.
I got my hands on this straight after hearing it was the key,
Rycroft says, folding his collar back over to hide the necklace. How did you even find out about that? No way had Rycroft gotten the information easily when I had to sell my country and my damn soul for it.
I am a man for hire, Rycroft says. And the Peggies are always looking for someone to do their dirty work. I had a few words with one of their princes a few years back after completing a job. You'd be surprised how loose his lips got after a few whiskies and some sweet nothings.
I bristle. Rycroft had played the seducer, using a charm conjured from hell knows where, while I had to put my country on the line. He had nothing to lose, so he'd traded nothing. Whereas I had an entire kingdom to lose, and I'd offered it at a bargain price. too caught up in my own crusade to even stop to think. Pathetic. I was starting to feel really damn pathetic. "Why do you want to kill the Sea Queen?" I asked. "Hero isn't exactly your color." Ryecroft rolls his shoulders back. "I don't give a damn about your little war with the Octobitch," he says. "I care less about her lifespan than I do yours." "Then what?" Ryecroft's eyes are hungry. "All the power of the ocean," he says. "If I get that crystal, then I control the oldest magic there ever was." He takes a swig of rum and then slams the goblet back onto the table hard. "And if the Sea Queen gives me any trouble, I'll put her and her little bitches back in their place."
Lyra's lips curl. "Is that so?"
"It's a fact," he tells her. "Let them try to come for me."
The fabric of Lyra's dress is bunched between her fists, and when she makes like she's going to stand, I place a hand on her knee. We're far too outnumbered to start throwing punches. "Why the charade of having your man come to Midas and feed me information?" I ask. "Why get me involved at all?"
"I'm not an idiot," Ryecroft says, though I beg to differ. "Nobody can make the climb up the mountain and live to tell the tale. The Ice Prince may have been willing to tell me about some ancient necklace nobody'd seen in a few lifetimes, but he wasn't going to give up the most carefully guarded secret of their bloodline. And you knew that it was information I could get." "You're the Prince of Midas," he says. "Royalty sticks together, doesn't it? I knew you'd all be in on one another's dirty secrets. Or if you weren't, you could be."
And he was right. I managed to weasel my way into the secrets of Sakura's family just like Ryecroft knew I would, learning things I had no right to for a mission he had planned. All of my talk about being a captain, telling Kai I wasn't some naive prince to be advised and influenced. And all the while I was playing into the hands of Talus Ryecroft and his merry band of miscreants.
"So you planned to use me to find out the way up the mountain?" "Not just that," Ryecroft says. "I need entry, too. I'm not about to start a war with the piggies by trespassing on their mountain. They'd know I was there the second I started to climb, and they'd be on me and my guys before I got anywhere near the Ice Palace. A pirate isn't gonna get close to that crystal."
Lyra slinks back into her chair, realization dawning on her face the moment it does mine.
"But a prince might," she says.
Ryecroft claps his hands together.
"Smart girl," he says,
then turns to me, his arms wide and welcoming.
"Your diplomatic connections are gonna come in handy, golden boy. If my bets are right, you've already talked your way into some kind of deal with them. Offered them something in exchange for entry. If I'm with you, I can stroll right on up there with nobody on my back, and then loot the whole damn place. By the time they realize what me and my lot are doing, I'll already have the power of the ocean in my hands."
"Great plan," I say. Only problem being that I'm not telling you a thing, and my schedule is a little packed to take you on a guided tour of a mountain.
"Not like I thought you'd be easy," Ryecroft says. "But you don't have to take me anyway. We're taking you."
The Zapra inch closer, creating a circle around us.
"As for the information, I can torture that out of you and your little lady on the way. It'll be a time saver."
I smirk and look over at Lyra. She blinks, not in shock, but as though she is considering what he's saying like a proposition rather than a threat. If she's scared, she does a good job of hiding it. She lifts her rum from the table with a slow and steady hand.
"Just so we understand each other," she says, swirling the goblet indifferently.
"I'm not his lady.
Before I can register the look on Rycroft's face, Lyra lurches forward and throws the golden liquid straight into his eye. Rycroft lets out an ungodly howl, and I jump to my feet, knife drawn, as the pirate clutches his face where the gold dust slices with every blink.
"You bitch!"
he snarls, blindly drawing his sword. Lyra pulls out the small dagger she slipped into her boot earlier, and I press my back to hers. Rycroft's shadows surround us, and from the corner of my eye I see snipers gather on the quarterdeck. I can take a dozen men, maybe, but even I'm not bulletproof. And Lyra, for all the fire that runs through her veins, is not invincible.
"You think that was clever?"
Rycroft wipes his eyes with the back of his sleeve. "Maybe not," Lyra says. "But it was funny."
"Funny?"
He takes a step closer, and I see the anger rolling from him like smoke.
"I'll show you funny."
I arch my body, turning our positions so Lyra squares off with the Zapra, and I come face to face with Rycroft. "No point crying over spilled rum," I tell him. For a moment, Rycroft stares at me, deathly still. His lips curl upward, and he blinks back a dribble of blood from his left eye.
"To think," he says, "when I tortured you, I was going to let you keep your most precious appendage."
When he lunges, I push Lyra to the side and dart back. The Zapra clear a path for us and then circle like vultures, ready to peck at the leftover carcass of the kill. Rycroft brings his heavy sword down, and when my knife meets it, the sparks are blinding. I kick at his knee, and Rycroft stumbles back with a hiss, but it's only seconds before he's on me again, slashing and swiping with his sword, lethal blows primed to kill. I jump back, and his blade slices across my chest. I don't take my focus off him to register the pain. He's mad to try this, to attack not just a prince, but a captain. Spilling royal blood is punishable by death, but spilling mine? Well, my crew would think death was too kind. I thrust my arm forward, aiming my dagger for his stomach. Rycroft twists out of the way barely, and I feel my ankle slip. Saving what little grace I have, I plunge the blade into his thigh. I feel the jar of bone as it settles inside his leg. When I pull, my hand comes away empty. Rycroft clasps a hand around the knife. He looks inhuman, like even pain is too scared to touch him now. Without ceremony, he yanks on the handle hard, and the blade oozes from him. It comes away clean, and for a moment, I worry that Rycroft will see the otherworldly shine on the steel. But the pirate barely glances at it before tossing it across the ship.
"What now?" he asks. "No more tricks."
"You'd kill an unarmed man?" I raise a taunting finger.
"I think we both know that you're never unarmed, and that when I kill you, it'll be a damn sight slower than this."
He lurches his head in a gesture to someone behind me. I'm able to spare one last look to Lyra, taking in the blinding light of her eyes, flared in warning before a shadow pitches toward me. I whip my head back a second too late, and a blinding pain explodes against my skull.
27. Lyra. I bring my tongue to the cut of my lip. My hands are secured to a large beam, and on the other side of the room, tied to an identical shaft, Elian sags on the floor. He looks every bit the handsome prince, even with his head slumped against the splintered wood, his injury matting his hair. His jaw ticks as he sleeps. And when his eyes flutter as though they're about to open, something snags in my chest. He doesn't wake. His breathing is hitched, but I'm surprised he's even breathing at all. I heard the crunch as the bat connected with the back of his head. A coward's blow. Elian was winning, and in just a few more minutes, even without that knife he loves so damn much, he would have killed Talus Rycroft. with his bare hands if he had to. And I would have helped. If I had my song, I wouldn't have even wasted it on a man like Talus. Let him drown, knowing the horror of death, without the comfort of beauty or love. Elian has an army, and we should have used that to attack Rycroft. But the prince prefers trickery to war. Get away clean, he said, before anyone can notice what we've taken. I looked to my hands, smeared with Elian's blood. This is not getting away clean. In the sea, mermaids sing songs about humans. There's one they hum like a child's lullaby, which weaves the story of Keto's slaughter. In it, the mermaids speak of human bravery and how they claimed victory against all odds. But until I was dragged onto Elian's ship, I'd never seen courage from a human. Even the strongest men fell under my spell, and those I didn't lure were too scared to challenge me. Elian is different. He has courage, or recklessness masked as something like it. And he also has mercy. Mercy even for creatures like Maeve, whose life he took as a last option. He didn't want to savor it. He just wanted it over with. Like I had with the Kallochiron prince. With Krestel. I wonder if I'd be that sort of a killer if I had been raised human. Merciful and hesitant to shed blood. Or, perhaps, if I wouldn't have been a killer at all. If I would have just been a girl, like any other who walked the world. Keto created our race in war and savagery, but it was the Sea Queens who took her hate and made it our legacy. Queens like my mother, who taught their children to be empty warriors. Elian's family taught him to be something else. The kind of man willing to throw a strange girl out of harm's way and battle a tyrannical pirate in her place. The chivalry I used to scoff at has saved my life twice now. Is that what it means to be human? Pushing someone else out of danger and throwing yourself in? Every time I protected Kalia, the Sea Queen chided me for my weakness and punished us both as though she could beat the bond out of us. I spent my life rethinking every look and action to be sure there wasn't any visible affection in either. She told me it made me inferior, that human emotions were a curse. But Elian's human emotions are what led him to save me, to help me, to trust that I'll do the same when the time comes. Elian stirs and lets out a low groan. His head lolls and his eyes flicker open. He blinks in his surroundings, and it only takes a few moments before he notices the restraints binding his hands. He tugs, a half-hearted attempt at escape, and then cranes his head toward me. From across the room, I see his elegant jaw sharpen. Lyra? His voice is as coarse as sand. He must see blood somewhere. It seems to be everywhere, because the next thing he asks is, "Where are you hurt?" Again, I lick the crack in my lip where Talus struck me. The blood is warm and bitter. "I'm not." I angle my face away so he doesn't see otherwise. "You bled all over me." Elian's laugh is more of a scoff. "Charming as ever," he says. He takes in a long breath and closes his eyes for a moment. The pain in his head must be getting the best of him, but he tries to swallow it and appear the brave warrior, as though it would be an offense for me to see him as anything else. "I'll kill him for this," Elian says. "You should make sure he doesn't kill us first." Elian tugs at the rope again, twisting his arm in the most bizarre angles in an attempt to slip the restraints. He moves like an eel, slippery and too quick for me to see what he's doing from where I'm sitting. "Enough," I say when I see the rope begin to redden his skin. "You're not helping." "I'm trying," Elian tells me. "Feel free to yank your own thumb out of its socket anytime soon. Or better yet, how about you use that siren to call some sirens here and let them kill us before Rycroft has a chance?
I flick my chin up. We wouldn't be here if you hadn't insisted on such a ridiculous plan.
I think getting my head smashed in may have affected my hearing.
Elian's voice loses its usual musicality.
What did you just say?
You didn't even realize he was tricking you, I say, and you walked right into his hands.
Elian's shoulders twitch. He has the necklace, so whether I knew about his ambush or not, I still would have come. I've sacrificed too much to fall at the last hurdle.
As though you've ever had to sacrifice anything, I shoot back, thinking of the kingdom I have hanging on the line. You're the prince of a kingdom that's full of brightness and warmth.
And that kingdom is exactly what I've sacrificed.
What does that mean?
Elian sighs. It means that my deal with the princess was about more than just a map and a necklace.
His voice is rueful.
I promised she could rule alongside me if she gave me her help.
My lips part as the weight of his words sinks through the air. While I'm trying everything I can to steal my throne from my mother, Elian is busy bargaining his away for treasure. Just like a pirate.
Are you stupid?
The disbelief shoots like a bullet from my mouth.
Finding the crystal could save lives, Elian says, and marrying a Pagese princess wouldn't exactly be bad for my country. If anything, it'll be more than my father ever dreamed of me achieving. I'll be a better king than he could have hoped for.
Though the words should be overcome with pride, they are rough and bitter, tinged in as much sadness as they are resentment. I think about how much time I spent trying to make my mother proud. Enough that I forgot what it was like to feel content, or anything I wasn't ordered to feel. I let her gift me to a merman like I was nothing but flesh he could devour, all the while reasoning that it was something I had to do for my kingdom. And Elian has thrust that own perdition onto himself. To fulfill the burden of the world and the duty of his title, he's willing to lose the parts of himself he treasures the most, the freedom and the adventure and the joy, parts I barely remember having. I look away, discomforted by how much of myself I see in his eyes. Either way, you have to take his heart, I think to myself. What other choice is there?
If the necklace is that precious, I say, we should have just killed Talis to get it.
You can't just kill everyone you don't like.
I know that. Otherwise you'd be dead already.
But it's not true. It almost surprises me how untrue it is. Because I could have killed him, or at least tried, and fulfilled my mother's orders a dozen times over. The ceiling rattles before Elian can retort. There's a low rumble in the wind, and for a moment I think it might be the sea waves crashing against Talis Rycroft's pathetic excuse for a ship. But then the rumble grows louder, and a bang shakes the cabin. Dust rains from the ceiling, and beneath us the floorboards splinter. There's a chorus of yells and then nothing but the sound of cannons and gunfire, of screaming and dying, of the world descending into chaos. Elian pulls at the ropes with a new ferocity. He shuts his eyes and I hear a resounding pop. I stare in disbelief as he tries to pull his hand from the restraints, his left thumb now slack. Miraculously, it slips halfway down before the rope lodges against his skin.
Damn, he spits. It's too tight. I can't slip out.
The cabin groans. A large split slivers up the wall and the window frame cracks with the pressure. Above us, footsteps pound the deck and the thunderous clashing of swords is second only to the deafening snarl of cannon fire.
What is that? I ask. My crew.
Elian jerks at the rope again.
I'd recognize the sound of the sod cannons anywhere.
He gives me a smile to light up nations.
Listen to my girl roar.
They came for us?
Of course they came for us, Elian says. And if they've battered up my ship doing it, then there's going to be hell to pay. As soon as the words leave his lips, a cannonball crashes through the window. It shoots past me and collides with the wooden beam that holds Elian. He ducks his head with siren speed, and wood shavings rain down his back. My breath lodges and a feeling of nausea rises up through my stomach. Then Elian lifts his head and shakes the dust from his hair. I let loose a long breath, and my frenzied human heart returns to its normal rhythm. Elian surveys the massacre of wood around him. And then slowly, almost wickedly, he smiles. He rises to his feet and slips out from beneath the shattered beam. He jumps, bringing his bound hands under his feet and to his chest in one swift motion. Briefly, he scans the dank room for something to cut the rope, but the cabin is desolate save for its two prisoners. Elian glances at me, and his smile fades as he takes in my restraints. The undamaged beam ready to take me down with the ship. He looks at his tied hands, his thumb still painfully dislodged from the socket. The room that is too bare to make use of. The girl he can't seem to save. "Go," I tell him. Elian's eyes harden, darken, that green disappearing under a whirlpool of anger. "Being a martyr doesn't suit you," he says. "Just go," I hiss. "I'm not just going to leave you here." The sound of gunfire pierces the air, and a scream, a roar of fury so loud that I wince. Elian turns to the doorway. Outside, his crew could be dying. The men and women he calls family, marking their lives as forfeit to save their captain. And for what? For him to surrender his own life to save the very monster he has been hunting? A girl who has been plotting to steal his heart from under him. A traitor in every sense of the word. Both of us have put our lives and our kingdoms on the line to find the eye and overthrow my mother. If nothing else, I won't stand by and watch someone else lose their kingdom just so I won't be alone when I lose mine. Elian. My voice takes on a murderous calm.
I...
Run! I scream. And to my surprise, he does. His teeth grind for a moment before, jaw pulsing under the weight of the decision. And then he turns. Quick as an arrow, the young prince darts from the cabin and leaves me to my doom. 28. Lyra. I wait for death to come. There's a chance that when I die, I'll return to my siren form. The corpse of the mighty Prince's Bane, stuck inside a pirate ship. Perhaps a sunken ship. Perhaps where nobody but the mermaids will find me. My mother might even feign mourning at the loss of her heir, or simply command the Flesh Eater to help her make a new one. I'm feeling a bit too sorry for myself when Talis Rycroft bursts through the door. His eyes scratch over the cold and empty cabin, and he rips a wooden plank masquerading as a shelf from the wall, its rusted nails snapping with the force. His trousers are stained red from where Elian's knife went in. Through the tear, I can see thick black stitches crisscrossing his skin back into place. A rush job, but it seems to have done the trick. Elian must have missed any arteries. Talus's knuckles are raw and scratched pink. When he charges across the room, it's in a jagged limp. He spots the broken beam where Elian was and snarls, kicking the splinters at me. I don't flinch.
"Where is he?"
he barks. I cross one leg over the other and slump my shoulders indifferently. "You are going to have to be a little more specific." In two strides, Rycroft crosses the room and wraps his thick hands around my neck. He pulls me to my feet and growls.
"You tell me where he is,"
Talis hisses,
"or I'll snap your pretty little neck."
The weight of his hands around my throat reminds me of my mother's hold. I want to cough and splutter, but there doesn't seem to be enough air. There's a fury without measure in my veins, pushing and pulling my insides until all that's left is a deep pit of loathing. I twist my lips into a snarl of my own. You seem upset, I say. Talus wrenches his hands from me.